Welcome to this podcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of the opening of Brisbane Botanic Gardens, Mount Coota. I'm Helen Jeremy from the Friends of Brisbane Botanic Gardens and Sherwood Arboretum, and in this episode I'm going to be talking to the President of BirdLife Australia, Professor Hugh Possingham. Hugh is a well-known and highly respected bird watcher, so we'll be talking about the birds in Mount Coota Gardens. You also might know Hugh as the former Queensland Chief Scientist, but his major role has been being a leader and groundbreaker in conservation research. As Chair of the Board of the Biodiversity Council, Hugh is an outstanding advocate for nature conservation. Welcome, Hugh.
Good morning, Helen. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you about birds in the gardens. But I'd like to start with talking about conservation, since you've got such an amazing career in that field. We hear so much about biodiversity, climate change, threatened species. A lot of it's conflicting sometimes, and it's hard to get an idea about what's the really accurate picture about what's happening. And yes, I look at you, you're a mathematician and an ecologist, and so you're supporting your observations with data and rigour, and I'd value your assessment in knowing what's really going on. So how would you describe the current state of Australia's biodiversity?
Yes, thanks, Helen. Good question. And it is confusing. And I would say, when I'm talking to people, my neighbours in Brisbane, they say, I see a lot of birds. I've got possums in the roof. There's a carpet python around. On a time frame of their last 20 or 30 years of experiencing nature in and around Brisbane and most Australian cities, they'd say, this all seems okay. If anything, people have planted more trees in the suburbs than used to be here. But if you look across the nation and you look at the data, one thing we did when I was director of a threatened species hub is we assembled an enormous amount of data on threatened species across Australia. So Australia has over 2,000 threatened species. They go through a formal listing process to determine whether they're threatened or not. That number keeps going up, which is alarming in its own right. But we've assembled, I think it's now 40,000 sets of data on those threatened species, 40,000 sets of data. This is where a species of bird or threatened plant or mammal, etc., is counted consistently over a period of time. And we've analysed those trends. And broadly speaking, in the last 25 years, since 2000 in this century, the abundance of threatened species has been declining around 3 or 4% every year. The net loss is about 50% over that period of time. So threatened species are doing very poorly. And the overall abundance of wildlife is also going down, even amongst common species. So it's not just the threatened species. So the data's in. At a global scale, there's a number of scientific publications in the world's best journals showing that the rate at which species are currently going extinct in the world is around 100 to 1,000 times the normal rate. So often people say to me, oh, well, extinction happens. It's a natural process. Of course it does. Most of the species that have ever appeared on the planet in the last few hundred million years have disappeared, like dinosaurs. The trouble is, at the moment, the speed of extinction is massively outpacing the speed of evolution. And so we have a decline in diversity. In fact, if we can't get a hold on this, or let's say going back to Australia and birds, which is my passion, we're typically losing one species or subspecies of bird every decade now. Then in 200 or 300 years' time, which I know sounds like a long time away in the history of humanity, it's actually pretty short. In 200 or 300 years, we could have lost as much as half of all the species of bird in Australia if we keep this pace of loss up. So I think that's disaster, and I think it's something we really need to focus on stopping.
I think everyone's very aware about loss of species, because we do hear about it all the time. And I was going to ask you whether you thought it was a crisis, but you've described it as a disaster, so I presume that's pretty much the same thing.
Well, if we lose half the species in Australia, let's say over the next 1,000 years, the time it would take for that diversity to recover is the order of 2 million years. Mm-hmm. So something like tens of thousand times as many people as have ever lived will suffer the consequences of what we're doing now. And they'll be saying, they won't be worrying about whether the Brisbane Lions won the AFL or other bizarre things that we see in the news on a daily basis. They'll be thinking, why did your generations, the generations of the 20th and 21st century, wipe out so much of nature? Why did you wipe it out? Because we can't get it back. It's gone forever, right? Or unless you're willing to wait for 2 million years. So the problem with this crisis is not like a cyclone where you've got a day or two to prepare and a day of event and then you've got to fix it up. It's not like a massive fire. It's not even like a famine, which might play out over months. It's something that's playing out over hundreds of years, and therefore it's very difficult for people to engage in that. But when the recovery time, if there's a flood, it's a pain in the neck. Occasionally people even die. But mostly in Australia, infrastructure and other things around floods, what they get fixed up in a year or two. It's fixed and done, and you're back to normal. But now we're talking about a disaster that's going to take over a million years to recover from. Even more, of course, than climate change, which probably we can recover from in 100 or 200 years. So it's still going to take a long time. So the problem is the time frame, and therefore it's very difficult to people to engage in such long time frames, but of course the impact is even longer.
I think the public really does care a lot about threatened animals, in particular. There's a lot of emotion about the loss of cute furry animals and birds, and that's probably got a higher profile than threatened plants. And perhaps, you know, do we have a tendency to ignore plants when they're really the backbone of an ecosystem in a way?
We do ignore plants. And I will say also, I'd say people also care a lot about common birds. So just before, I will get onto plants. Like when I'm giving bird walks, and I give about 15 public bird walks a year, people are actually noticing willy wagtails are disappearing. Everybody loves a willy wagtail. Most people had one in their back garden 20 or 30 years ago, and their abundance has, again, more than halved, so it's dramatically dropped. So people are relating to common things as well, not just threatened species, and they find it very disappointing. Things like dollar birds, once common in Brisbane, now they're impossible to find.
Oh, you never hear anyone talk about a dollar bird these days. No.
They're around in tiny numbers, and they eat big insects, and to your point, what do the big insects live on? They live on plants. Most insects are herbivores. In fact, they're living on rotten wood. So, in fact, it's old rotten wood. And, of course, old rotten wood is few and far between in the suburbs because people tend to clean things up all the time. But getting back to the plants, I mean, the situation for plants is just as bad, if not worse, than the birds and the mammals. They just don't get the publicity. Of those over 2,000 listed, Australian-listed threatened species, about 60% are plants. So they're by far the majority of them. A huge number are orchids. I'm a big fan of terrestrial orchids in particular. They dominate the threatened species list. And there are many orchids, at least a couple of hundred on the list. And some of their populations are tiny. I mean, it's down to 25 individuals in the corner of a cemetery somewhere in Victoria or South Australia. So we're talking about many species that are almost extinct. That said, when we've done a lot of analyses trying to help different state governments prioritise their investment in conservation, particularly New South Wales, Queensland, South Australia, Tasmania, and we tell them if you really want to stop extinctions, the low-hanging fruit, if you can excuse the pun, is plants.
Mm.
Because a lot of these species, I mean, orchids are a bit tricky, I have to say, but a lot of threatened plants, they just need to have their populations fenced, weeded, protected from destruction and development. They can occur in just hectares of land, so not expensive to buy or manage, and they can be done by local community groups. You don't have to have a special permit to do these things. You need to work with, of course, local government and state government to do these things. And then, of course, it's not too hard to get permission to collect their seeds, to grow them, to plant them out, because many of the things people don't also understand, if there's a population of a threatened plant and there's a few hundred on the side of a hill, like an orchid, they're very vulnerable to catastrophic events. So what we really need is most species needs to be in several places. In fact, we would argue 5 to 10 places is the minimum, and those 5 to 10 places need to have a few hundred individuals. So risk spreading is very important. And this is, you know, to be honest, when I finish most of my public lectures and people say, what can I do? I say, other than reducing your meat consumption, the best thing you can do is join a local community group like Queensland Threatened Plant Network, which we set up a couple of years ago, and work with them to save some of these rare and threatened plants, of which there are hundreds of species around Brisbane and all over Queensland.
Orchids, I think, are an interesting plant because my understanding is they have specialised pollinators. So we're relying on particular insects to be there. Now, we've just previously done a podcast with Paul Harrop and Kev Russell about macrophotography of insects in Brisbane Botanic Gardens, Mount Coot-tha. And whilst I understand there's not a lot of sort of public scientific data on the number of insects, Paul and Kev gave us some anecdotal evidence, and they were talking about how in their 15 years or so of taking photos in the Mount Coot-tha Gardens, they're finding that there are a lot less insects than there used to be.
And they're right, yeah. So the global insect decline is now a phenomenon that's been reported in multiple places all over the world, particularly in Europe, where they have a lot better data on invertebrates, moths, the butterflies, a lot of the bees, and important things like pollinators, as you say. So it's quite alarming. The most alarming thing about these declines in often just the abundance but also the diversity of insects is nobody's quite sure exactly why. So is it partly the first bits of climate change? And the world's warmed up 1.5 degrees very rapidly in the last 50 or so years. Is that the problem? And there's lots of reasons why it could be a problem. Climate change also, remember, that's elevated carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. That changes the chemistry of plants. So a lot of plants are less nutritious than they used to be because they have excessive amounts of carbon, and so the carbon-nitrogen balance is different. And what a lot of insects need is nitrogen from plants, particularly if they're herbivores, and they need to get lots of nitrogen. They may be swamped by carbon. Nobody really knows whether that's happening. Or is it persistent pesticides? So pesticides are used in and around houses, but also in agricultural systems. Many of those pesticides have been designed to be long-lasting, and some of them spread way off the target application. And so we do genuinely fear that some pesticides and their spread and their persistence has caused declines. We're trying to get a lot of the companies to make pesticides that stay put and don't last forever, which actually is good for their business model in a sense. But yes, to be honest, so you're right, insects are in decline. That has a massive effect on pollination and plants, and that's been observed around Australia. It has an impact on the birds as well, which are also often pollinators. So it is a worry that the whole system is just slowly collapsing before our eyes. The lack of data on insects is phenomenal. Lots of anecdotal evidence that insects are in decline around Australia, but very little quantitative, statistically rigorous data.
You've talked about what we can do, how we can join a community group to help save a plant species, and at a really individual level we could reduce our meat consumption. What about at our government level? Are we spending enough on conservation?
Yeah, we've done a lot of analyses of government spending on nature, and unfortunately it's continuing to go down over the last 20 or 30 years. And it doesn't really matter whether you vote red, blue, green, pink, orange, or whatever the colours are. All our political parties have been reducing spending on nature. In fact, the current budget that just came out, we found that 0.06% of government spending is on nature. So it's about $500 million, which you may think, oh, $500 million, that's a lot. Well, it's a $800 billion budget. It's gigantic. And of course, we've just bought a whole heap of submarines, which I think will do almost nothing. If all that money went into nature, we would stop extinctions quite quickly. So it's a tiny amount of budget. Many of you listening will pay tax. When you pay your tax, you get something back saying where your tax dollars went. Tell me if you see the environment or nature bar, it doesn't exist. I don't even know where it's hidden because it's so tiny. So, yeah, our spending both at a state and federal level on nature is extremely low. I would have to say I've spent the last, since I was the age of 16, trying to get governments to spend more money on nature, and I've completely failed. We've had the odd good environment minister like Robert Hill, who did a lot, but very rarely do we get anywhere at a state level as well. So I'm sort of slowly giving up. I mean, the best thing as individuals we can do is ask for a meeting with our local politicians. Everybody's represented at the local government level, the state government level, and the federal government level. If you're in their electorate, you can ask for a meeting, and then in that meeting you would say, I love orchids, I love birds, I love nature, I understand we have an extinction crisis. Here's the Threatened Species Index, you can pull it up, tsx.org.au, on your phone. You can show them the data, 40,000 time series, unequivocal. We showed it to Graham Samuels when he was reviewing the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, and we turned him into a greenie in 1 minute, just by showing him the volume of data that is the nature crisis. And say, I want you to do more about this. I want this to stop. And that's the most powerful thing an individual can do. It doesn't actually suit everybody, but if you do get up the courage and muscle to write one letter and ask for a meeting, please do it.
Well, it's a simple thing for us to do. And as you said, it's just one letter, one phone call. And the more of us who do it, the more it will help.
That's right. The politicians, they do, in theory, I mean, we're democracy of a form, they're there to do the job that we want. And if you say, this is the job we want to do, in theory, they do it. And we do know, through various surveys, 95% of Australians love nature. There aren't many people who hate it. Very few.
Yeah. Well, we can see that when we know we do go to the Botanic Gardens and it's full of people there looking around. How do Botanic Gardens help in the conservation process?
Yeah. Well, a lot of botanic gardens both have seed banks. I mean, first of all, they decide what species are, so the herbarium there in the Brisbane Botanic Gardens. If you don't know what you're dealing with, you don't know what the species are, and we're continually finding new species, so the research is essential. The botanic gardens themselves can have living collections. They have seed banks. They have various other ways of storing plant material that can potentially be reconstituted. So there's a lot of research going on. I think as time progresses, we're trying to move towards gardens, or you'd say living plant collections. So you mentioned the pollinators, and, you know, we could, for example, save some of these terrestrial orchids through tissue culture and seeds and probably keep them around for a long period of time. But when we go to plant them out, a specialised wasp that once pollinated it may have long gone. It depends how specific those pollinators are to those particular plant species. So the better situation, I suppose, and where I think in Queensland we need to move to, it started in South Australia and Victoria, is what you'd call rare and threatened seed gardens, where instead of just having a few individuals of a threatened species, you try and put it in a more natural setting with a broader diversity of plants, but keeping a few hundred or at least dozens of individuals of that threatened species and use it as sort of a living source of material and seeds, and having the potential to maintain the other species alongside it. Now, again, many of these insects we don't know very little about. There's mycorrhizae that they orchids need as well. So I'm not saying that's going to be perfect, but the more we can keep things in botanic gardens in more natural circumstances in larger populations. Now, that won't work necessarily for trees, but it can certainly work for a lot of smaller geophytes and herbaceous material.
Yes, certainly it's lovely to see it the Mount Coothar Gardens, the Queensland Conservation Collection, where a lot of plants from around the state have been put into areas which resemble their natural habitat of their original regions. But as you say, it is a challenge to try to get hundreds of those plants in there. It's good that botanic gardens do provide lots of different plants because they're creating a wonderful habitat and a habitat for wildlife, and especially for birds. And I suppose now I'd sort of like to move on and discuss your career as a lifelong bird watcher. Their friends were very lucky recently to have you lead an activity of a bird walk in the Mount Coothar Gardens and to share your expertise there. So what sort of things did you find in the gardens?
We had a really successful walk. I must admit, standing in the car park waiting for everybody to turn up, I got mildly depressed because car parks and those areas around human infrastructure and grassy areas tend to be overwhelmed with noisy miners. And noisy miners, as many people know, they're a native species. They're a kind of honey eater. So, you know, they are part of our ecosystem. But their abundance has gone through the roof. And they're very aggressive and they hold very strong territories. They weigh about 60 grams and everything smaller than 60 grams, they tend to chase away. So I think as we were waiting there, as people arrived, I ended up with a bird list of 14 species. The only thing that was smaller than a noisy miner was one lonely, scared Wilkins swallow flying over. So what's happened in Brisbane is we've become dominated by bigger birds. The birds that can deal with noisy miners attacking them all the time. That said, as we were expertly guided through to the back of the park, I said, let's see if we can get away from the noisy miners. And right up in the back corner, up against Mount Coothar, there was a lovely pond. That pond, first of all, had an azure kingfisher in it, which is amazing. Azure kingfishers are, I would say, one of the most spectacular kingfishers in the world. We have 11 species of kingfisher. This is possibly the most beautiful, dark, vivid blue back, a rusty chest, and a ridiculously reddy orange legs. Very hard to see. They're there in the back pond in quiet places away from everybody, spectacularly beautiful, and we all got good views of the azure kingfisher. Almost impossible to hear because they don't make much noise. And as we worked further up, we got away from the noisy miners and we were treated with a lot of birds. We got, I think, over 40 species by the end of the morning, in particular great views of golden whistlers, Australian golden whistlers, bright yellow, beautiful call, scarlet miser mealers, another kind of small honey eater. They're bright red and they actually came right down and we got quite good views of them. So, yeah, it's certainly a good list, 45 species. I mean, if I was back in the United Kingdom where I did my PhD, if I saw 45 species in an entire weekend, I'd be ecstatic. So it is amazing how much you can see in the gardens around Brisbane.
Well, that area around what you described as a pond, which does have a name called Melaleuca Lake, it's a lovely natural area. And on the Mount Coothar side of it, there is quite dense bush cover, which is perfect for these little birds, isn't it?
Exactly.
Talking about the scarlet honeyeater, and is that where you found pardalots as well?
Yes, the Striae pardalots. I suspect they may be nesting in some of the banks there. They do like nesting in hollows in trees, but if they can't get a hollow in a tree, and again, we're still missing a lot of old trees around Brisbane because everything was once pretty well logged and flattened. But they will punch a hole into a muddy bank or into even a pile of mulch and try and make a nest there. Yeah. A lot of these come down in the winter as well. So, in fact, most of what we're talking about now have all come down out of the hills, and some of them have come north from Victoria. Even the silver ivy we heard was probably from Tasmania. They've come into Brisbane in winter. So in many parts of the world, winter's a bit of a miserable time to go bird watching. In Brisbane, because it's subtropical, we get all these interesting and exciting birds coming up from colder places or coming down out of the mountains.
Yes. Well, it's fabulous that there is an area like that. And I'd encourage, our listeners, next time you're at Mount Coothar Gardens, go up to that back section of the gardens. Not a lot of people go there because you have to walk up a hill. Yeah. But once you go over and down the hill, you'll find just a beautiful natural area, densely planted in places with Australian plants, and because these are great hidey holes. So it's really important that botanic gardens do have places like these where there's little disturbance and where, yes, you know, the wildlife can interact with the plants.
Yeah, and the other thing, we did see quite good water birds right there at the cafe in that pond, whatever that pond's called.
Oh, they're the water lily ponds. Yeah.
Water lily pond. Yeah. And, you know, we were had a beautiful view of a royal spoonbill, some Australian, Australasian grebes and some cormorants. And so they've actually somewhat habituated what I'm finding at the Sherwood Arboretum, particularly is when there's heavily visited places, some of the water birds suddenly realise, oh, people don't shoot us. They don't kill us. They've got their dogs on lead. And in fact, of course, in the Brisbane Botanic Gardens, there's no dogs at all. And they've become really tame. So it's a luxury to see egrets and spoonbills up very, very close, right there in the middle of the city. Yeah.
Well, if you mention Mount Coot-tha Gardens and birds, I think most people would instantly think of the Water Lily Lake, because that's where you see all the ducks and the swamp hens, and the odd spoonbill. And sometimes you see curlews as well.
Good.
Yeah, so it's particularly when you get round to that Ross McKillen Lagoon, there's often curlews, yeah, pottering
the
around.
The curlews have become very, very, deal very well with people. They get agitated when they see a dog. That they do are very happy with people.
Yeah. Well, which is the beauty of a botanic gardens, having no dogs in there as well, because it does let the bird life do its own thing.
Yeah, and in places where the dogs are kept on leads, and I think Brisbane people are getting better and better at keeping their dogs on a lead. They don't all do, but the birds also work that out as well. And, you know, the rise and rise of brush turkeys, Australian brush turkeys, is probably attributed to the fact that people can tame their dogs, and the brush turkeys now know this. They can tell what dog's on a lead and what isn't. 40-50 years ago, most of them weren't, and they were all chased or killed. But now the brush turkeys, they're smart. Birds are smart. Yes. A lot of the things we have, birds in Australia, like the cockatoos and the magpies and butcher birds, they've got a mental age of about a four-year-old. And those of you who know four-year-olds, they're stupidly smart.
Very cunning, yes.
Manipulative, that's right, that's what they are.
Now, Hugh, you've been a bird watcher for such a long time and are so accomplished at it. Can you give some tips for people who are starting out? So if someone was going to the gardens, what would you suggest they do to sort of maximise their ability to be able to see some different birds?
Yeah, I mean, a reasonable pair of binoculars is important. Sometimes people have these fairly cheap binoculars, and unfortunately, if you buy binoculars under, say, $100 or $150, it's frustrating. So you do have to shell out for something around $400 or so. My binoculars are very expensive. They're $5,000. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that. Then again, people say, that's expensive. I say, my only hobby, I do it for 10 hours a week, and I've worked out they're costing me 20 cents an hour. So cheap hobby. There are good bird apps, and there's good bird books. The bird apps, some of the books now comes with applications you can load up on your phone and you can listen to the bird calls. There's also a great new app that's got better and better recently called Merlin. It's built out of Cornell University in the United States. And that is like a Shazam for birds. You can turn it on. It's very easy to load up. And it tells you what you're hearing. So it identifies them as you hear. If the calls are made, it comes up with a picture of the bird, and it comes up, says, you've just heard a grey butcher bird, or you've just heard a pied currawong. Now, it's not perfect yet. So, for example, on our bird walk, my bird walks in the Arboretum, which I normally get around about 40 species, it probably misses half. The half it misses, a lot of them are birds that just don't make a noise. Like you can't, Merlin can't identify a spoonbill because as far as I can tell, spoonbills almost never make a noise, little white cormorant. And then most of the noisy birds it does identify, there's a few that it's missing, and very occasionally it'll make a mistake. But it's actually not a bad way of getting to learn some of the calls. So, for example, the scarlet miser mela we were listening to, it was calling and it would come up. The golden whistler was actually virtually not calling, so it probably wouldn't come up. But it does help a little bit with the calls. People often say to me, how do you know so many calls? And I say, well, I've been bird watching since I was 10. So it's just time listening, thinking, watching, learning.
It's good you've brought to our attention the need to be listening for calls, because I suppose if you're going bird watching, you're thinking, I'm going to look for birds. Now, that's easier if you're down at the Walter Lily Lake, and they're all very obvious. So when we get to more heavily wooded areas then, and the birds might be hiding, we really need to stop and listen. Is that your advice?
Definitely. Stop, listen. And it's even just fun to just listen to the diversity of sounds. People often don't stop and listen at all. So it's a soothing activity. And many places around Brisbane, if I stop and listen for 5 minutes, I can hear 15 different species just listening to what's going on. So, yeah, bird watching is, in some senses, a lie. Most bird watchers who do a lot are bird listening and a bit of watching. So sometimes we call ourselves birders.
Birders.
So we're just birding, and we use any sense that we can to try and work out what's around us. And it does add this extra dimension. It's sort of within a reasonable time you can identify all the birds by sight. I mean, human beings are very visual organisms, and we're very good at facial recognition. And the calls, though, learning all the calls is a lifelong task, because even though I might know all the bird calls from here to Adelaide, in the middle of Australia, I don't know them very well. Overseas, I don't know them very well. And many of these birds, like even the diminutive of a white-browed scrub wren, it'll have a dozen different calls. So you think you know the calls, you only know the common calls, and they'll always be doing things that are weird and interesting. So it adds a very rich and complicated dimension to the activity.
When you've been walking around the gardens, looking at the birds at Mount Coota, has it sort of created in your mind a favourite place in the gardens? Would you choose your favourite place in the gardens based on what birds are there, or are you
definitely
about the plants?
Yes. Oh, well, I mean, yeah, I like the plants, and I suppose I do have a particular passion for terrestrial orchids. They're not kind of things you can easily keep in the botanic gardens. In fact, I think brush turkeys would rip them to pieces quite quickly. Again, coming from South Australia, for various reasons, my heart has habituated into what I'd call South Australian dry, sclerophyll, heathy woodlands. So I love shrubby, dense heathlands with grevilleas and herbaceous. So all those sorts of places. The rainforest I sort of appreciate because it has very interesting birds in it, but I find it a little bit baffling identifying all those rainforest trees. I'm just used to dealing with sclerophyllous places. So places like around the Nathan campus, I feel more at home because I see more of that. And in the botanic gardens, those things with more sclerophyllous plants is the places that I feel more at home in.
So you'd probably like the area of the native plants for Brisbane, where you've got all those bushes of grevilleas and everything, and leading on that nice walk down below the Bunya Forest.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yes, great. Hugh, it's been really great to get your insights into birds in botanic gardens. I know next time I'm going to go, I'm going to try to get my ears to work more than my eyes, and I'm hoping our listeners will also do the same thing. So thank you for sharing that. I've also found your observations on conservation have been quite enlightening, a bit sobering, but also optimistic, because I think you've explained to us that something can be done, as individuals we can choose to make a difference. So let's try to encourage everyone to do that.
Yeah, and people often say to me, well, you've been doing this since you've 16 years old for 50 years. Why do you maintain your enthusiasm for conservation? I said, well, there's nothing much else you could do. Right? This is the thing that in 1,000 years' time people will be most annoyed about.
Yes.
This is the most important issue for the future of humanity, is maintaining biodiversity. It's important for our health. It's important for our physical and mental well-being. It's important for our economy. So it's worth fighting for, even if though you temporarily appear to be going backwards. I'm hopeful that, you know, by 2050, things will start to look a little bit better as we get more and more people on board to the importance of this issue.
Right. Well, thank you for your work in this area, Hugh, and thank you for talking to us today.
Thanks a lot, Helen. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Good. And we'd also like to thank Brisbane Lord Mayor's Community Fund, Councillor Greg Adaman, and Brisbane City Council Libraries for supporting our Friends podcasts. We'll be back with another episode to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Brisbane Botanic Gardens Mount Coot-tha. So do join us again.